The coronavirus generates the lead story in three of today's papers. The Irish Independent leads with the line that Dublin Airport has been advised by the HSE to trigger infection control precautions in the event of a passenger travelling from China showing potential symptoms. The Independent also references the case of the man who is undergoing tests at the Royal Hospital in Belfast, which provides a lead story in today's Belfast Telegraph. It's reported that the man travelled to Northern Ireland from the city of Wuhan, where the virus originated last weekend. Details from an interview carried on this programme yesterday with Irishman Ben Kavanagh, who is currently working as a teacher in Wuhan, provides a lead story in the Irish Daily Mirror. Elsewhere on the front pages, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil manifestos will favour spending increases over tax cuts. That's the lead headline in the Irish Times, which reports that the two parties are expected to announce their manifestos for a five-year term in government later today. And that paper also flags an opinion piece by Stephen Collins on its front page today under the headline, Electoral Defeat Could Spell End for Varadkar or Martin. The Examiner leads with the inquest into the death of four-year-old Killian O'Driscoll, who died in hospital after he became acutely ill at the Kindercare childcare creche in Ballincollig in December 2018. Cork Coroner's Court heard yesterday that Killian had been diagnosed with autism and had communication difficulties, which the creche was aware of. His parents, John Paul and Deirdre O'Driscoll, are pictured on the front of today's paper. For its lead story, the Echo reports on videos which were posted by rival gangs in Cork City on social media this week, in which the men who have their faces covered and some of whom are carrying implements issue threats of violence. Another post on social media generates the lead story in today's Irish Daily Star. The paper publishes a picture which 43-year-old Linda Mulhall posted of herself and her daughter Nikita yesterday. Linda Mulhall was released from the Doka Centre in Mountjoy 2 years ago, having served 13 years for the manslaughter of Farah Noor in 2005. Her sister Charlotte is currently serving a life sentence for his murder. Under the headline, €15 million fraud gang's Irish fixer, the Herald leads with the 4.5 year jail sentence given to 28-year-old Radu Agapi from Romania in Dublin Circuit Criminal Court yesterday on charges related to the use of false documentation to open bank accounts. And finally, a squabble between two Fine Gael candidates in Mayo over election posters provides the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail. The row centres on the removal of between 30 and 40 posters which had been put up by Senator Michelle Mulhern's campaign team but were removed on Tuesday morning by members of the team canvassing on behalf of former Mayo footballer Alan Dillon. Craig Hughes reports that the Gardaí were contacted about the removal of the posters but ceased their investigations after speaking to Fine Gael Director of Elections for Mayo, Tom Garvey. Mr Garvey tells the paper that the posters were taken down on his instruction because they had been put up in an area outside of Senator Mulhern's boundary.
And a very good morning to you from the Old Ground Hotel here in Ennis. Throughout the election campaign, we're broadcasting from around the country, hearing about the issues that matter to people and examining what may swing their votes. This morning, we're in the four-seat constituency of Clare, which in 2016 returned two Fine Gael deputies, Pat Breen and Joe Carey, one Fianna Fáil TD, Timmy Dooley, and the independent deputy from West Clare, Dr Michael Harty. He's decided not to run again, and later we'll be hearing more about that decision. It's fair to say that in this constituency, as in many others, the health service has long been one of the big issues. The removal of 24-hour emergency services at Ennis General Hospital means that people from the county have to travel to Limerick, the hospital which invariably tops the league table for trolley waits. Additional beds are promised, something mentioned by Leo Varadkar in this week's TV debate, but they're not expected to materialise before the end of the year. Other long-running issues here include the status of Shannon Airport, the future of Moneypoint Power Station, and the plight of more rural areas. So 15 days out from polling day, what's on voters' minds? Our reporter Tommy Meskell has been finding out.
Housing and our health service are the two things I would like to see improved in Clare.
I think there's a very anti-rural bias at the minute, right? Okay.
I'm really concerned about finding a job in Clare.
It's 10 in the morning and we're on Abbey Street in Ennis. It's been a foggy start to the day, but ask people what's on their mind ahead of this election and they're quite clear.
I ask you just about the housing. Why did you say housing?
Because I have a son and his partner, and they have applied to 3 banks and was turned down for mortgage. They're on low wage, and they applied to the council for a council loan for the mortgage, and they were turned down there also.
The big issue, sure, the hospital, we're afraid of our life to have to go into hospital with the trolley situation, and that's the number one here in Clare. We have a small injuries unit in Innes from 8 o'clock in the morning until 8 in the evening, which is very good, but outside of that you haven't, and they don't see children. If you have a child under 5 years, you have to go into Limerick and queue.
You know, if I go to Dublin, the M50 is a car park, okay? Whereas down here, you know, Ennis is a big town, so it wouldn't be too bad, but rural communities along the Atlantic seaboard, or I'm originally from Monaghan, so I know what it's like up there as well. They have not benefited the way the East Coast has. So it's a very unbalanced development, you know.
The Wild Atlantic Way has brought with it a huge surge in tourists arriving to West Clare. The problem, however, is that the tide quickly goes back out. They're mostly day trippers, often heading back to Dublin in the evening.
My name is Geraldine Enright, Director of the Cliffs of Moher Visitor Experience. 2019 was a record year for the Cliffs of Moher. We welcomed just over 1.6 million visitors.
I suppose the downside to it, though, is that you're starting to hear from locals around you that they're not feeling the benefits.
You know, there's been a huge change in the dynamic of how visitors come to the Cliffs of Moher. We have introduced a new criteria for any new coach licenses that wish to come to the Cliffs of Moher visitor experience. So they have to meet a number of criteria. Number one is to visit outside of the peak times. Number two, that they would visit another fee-paying attraction or visitor experience within the county. And number three is that they would overnight in County Clare, again to spread that economic return to the west of Ireland local economy.
Ennis Diamond, just a few minutes from Lahinch, is one town on the rise, thanks to their proximity to the seaside destination.
My name is Raymond Foody. I own Foody's Cafe and Bakery on the main street here in Ennis Diamond.
Ennis Diamond is thriving, people say, is it?
Ennis Diamond is a traditional market town. There are numerous different types of business, and all of those help each other.
It's not the same story across West Clare. In fact, many people would say that West Clare is struggling in many ways with depopulation and a lack of jobs.
I would agree totally with you. I have a second cafe down in Milltown Malbay, and it's only 15 minutes drive, and it's a different story totally.
People coming down from Dublin, buses coming down from Dublin, they're going straight out to the cliffs and they're coming back out again, and they're not staying in Clare. Is that an issue for you guys?
That would be a big issue for us. That the biggest issue with the day trippers is Shannon Airport. Shannon Airport has one of the largest runways in Ireland, but it's not being used. There is a magnet to have them all in Dublin.
Money Point, the coal-burning power station, is in the middle of a wind-down. The problem is what replaces the station. Tony Slattery has retired from the plant, but as a local and friend of many still working there, he's worried.
The area from Milltown down to Loughpaid, to Ballinakelly, to Kildice, or to Lizzie Casey, and even Ennis will suffer because you have people travelling from all over to work there. And the other thing is you had a lot of small contractors around Kilrush supplying vital supplies there. And when that's gone, their income stream will go.
Money Point has to go, but the concern is what replaces it?
What will replace it? That's just it. All power plants wind up, they're decommissioned. But the jetty that's there, it's the jewel in the crown. The River Shannon is one of the best natural harbours in Europe, and the jetty should be put to good use for the people of the area.
Back in Ennis, we meet students from the small LIT campus based in the town. They're graduating soon, so jobs in the Midwest is a concern for them.
My line of interest has always been working with the disability sector. I've always had an interest since I was quite young.
Do you think you'll stay in Clare?
That's a good one. I would say I'd probably leave Clare just to give it a try. But if there are opportunities here, definitely would give it a go anyway.
My name is Louise and I'm from Clare. I do think for the most case, young people leave the Clare region to study. So they go to universities in Limerick or Galway, Dublin, And typically when they do graduate, they're looking for employment opportunities elsewhere. The opportunities are not really or haven't been here as much. It has improved, I do think, but I think people tend to move out of the Midwest.
That report from Tommy Meskell. We'll have more from County Clare later on in the programme. That
our political correspondent Paul Cunningham is here. It's Manifesto Day. Yay.
Yeah, Manifesto Day for people who are mad keen on the election is a big day, and particularly when you get two big ones in the same day, both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil launching their manifesto. And effectively what we get here is not just the policies and plans they have, but also how they're going to pay for it. And you get the chance to interrogate the various different finance people about what are they doing, why are they favouring spending over tax cuts, how are we going to be able to pay for this, what happens if Brexit goes wrong. You're able to ask those types of questions, and then equally later on in the day, both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are able to pull lumps out of each other because each has to be able to look at the other manifesto. So a big day and an interesting one.
What do you know about what's in them?
Well, Fianna Fáil, they're staying mum, but they have got an awful lot of policy already produced in the sort of few days of the campaign so far. With Fine Gael, we do have some idea, and I think it's no surprise that they're hitting on some of the themes that they've been under pressure on. One is health, one is housing, and the other is cost of living on childcare. Just on housing first, they are planning to have 1,400 service sites. So that's where you've got the roads, you've got the electricity, you've got power, you've got water services in. So 1,400 service sites in towns and villages under a population of 2,000 people to be made available at cost through your local authority for prospective owner-occupiers. And I think that's sort of an initiative where they're trying to, on the one hand, grow the towns and villages in the country, which we've heard on Morning Ireland over the past week, which are in real difficulty. It's also trying to get into territory where you're able to expand into those places in line with their plans for 2040. And you're also trying to take some pressure off the cities. You're probably talking about 8,000 housing units there, but they're going to say that it's a rolling fund. So once they sell those sites, the money will go back in and they can roll out that to other places. When it comes to health, some big ticket items, looks as if they're going to be spending around 5 billion euro over the next 5 years if they happen to be returned. And that figure is sort of bigger than most other parties. They're usually talking around 4 billion euro. They're talking about 5,000 additional nurses, 3,840 additional primary healthcare workers, 1 million extra home care hours every year of the government, increasing GP training services to 300 by 2025. And it's a small measure, but I think it might resonate with people. Capping hospital car parking charges at £10 or €10 a day. And we have heard people saying, when I'm under so much pressure to have to be running in and out, this measure, I think, will go to ease some of that. And they're also moving on childcare as well, where they're going to increase the childcare budget by 400 million to over a billion by 2025. So that's what Fine Gael are doing. And they're going to be launching at around 12 o'clock today.
And Fianna Fáil?
Well, Fianna Fáil are launching 2 hours later, so they've got something of an advantage.
By the way, Anorak Point, why are they both doing this on the same day?
I think, no, we don't know, we're going to ask them that question when we get there, but I think it's a political advantage. They have been skirting around the edges as to when they might produce the plan. It appeared earlier that Fianna Fáil were sort of looking towards Friday. Fine Gael were being more circumspect about when. They've both gone for the same day because I think, just as I was saying earlier on, once your manifesto's out, it's under immense scrutiny, and they both want to produce their certainly Fine Gael seems to want to produce their manifesto at the same time as Fianna Fáil, so they're cross-referencing against each other, two big parties. But Fianna Fáil has already launched many policies on health. They were reproducing on social media again. They've got 22 headlines, they've got 80 individual measures, so we're not going to be able to read it all out, but one of the big ones and the first one they have when it comes to health is tackling overcrowding in emergency departments, and they say they're going to increase bed capacity with the aim of a 4-hour target wait at emergency departments. They're going to improve access to diagnostics for emergency departments and GPs with a new minor capital fund of 50 million euro and commence 2,600 additional hospital beds, which has been recommended under the capacity review. Now, I think what we're seeing here is an interesting one when it comes to health, because all of the parties have signed up to Sláintecare, and that is a 5.8 billion euro plan over the next 10 years, and much of it to be front-loaded. So when it comes to health, everyone will be looking at, does this fit into Sláintecare? Is it above and beyond Sláintecare? And if it is above and beyond, does that undermine Sláintecare in itself? So those will be some of the themes that will be teased out.
Grand Coalition seemed to have been ruled out yesterday.
Yeah, it was an interesting one that was raised so early in the campaign anyway. When you're talking about the formation of a government and horse trading, usually that happens after everyone's voted and you've looked at the numbers and you've decided what is possible and what's not possible. It was a card played by Leo Varadkar very early on in his Virgin Media debate. The following day, yesterday, Micheál Martin ruled it out, said people are looking for change. The last thing they want is Fine Gael to come back in. And then from the sidelines of that debate, as they weren't there, Sinn Féin saying both those parties are the establishment parties, and on that basis we wouldn't enter into a confidence and supply deal with them.
What are we expecting over the next few days? Leo Varadkar is going to be appearing tonight on RT1 television at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, he's going to be an interview with Brian Dobson, the first of a series of leaders' interviews. On Saturday, the Green Party is going to be bringing out their manifesto. All the parties are going to be rolling them out over the next few days. We're going to have another opinion poll, this time the Business Post. Not sure when it's going to come out, Saturday night, Sunday morning, that's still unclear. And then as you roll into Monday and Tuesday, more manifesto launches.
Paul, thank you. That's our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham, more on the election throughout the programme. 23 minutes past 7. You can watch Morning Ireland as well as listen to us on RTE News Now on your phone, tablet or on television on Sairview. This morning our cameras are in studio, as always, in Ennis with Rachel. And in Switzerland, hands down the nicest backdrop of the morning, our business editor Will Goodbody is there for the final day of what has been an eventful week at the World Economic Forum in Davos. There was that Donald Trump, Greta Thunberg climate change spat, a lot of tough talking on trade by the US, EU, UK and China, and the thorny question of global corporation and digital taxation reform was discussed. But it's not over yet. Will, what's planned for the last day?
Good morning, Gavin. Well, aside from the last session of morning meditation, there are plenty of other events happening here. YouTuber Molly Burke, the chairman of Bloomberg and the president of Poland, are just some of those speaking today. But most keenly watched will be an economic session involving the ECB president, the IMF managing director, the German finance minister, the US Treasury secretary and the governor of the Bank of Japan, because business deals will always be the fundamental reason why many people come to Davos. But that aside, there seems little doubt Davos 2020 will be remembered as the year big business finally acknowledged it understands the catastrophic risks posed by climate change and that it's going to do something about it. One organisation that will be holding business leaders to that pledge is the World Benchmarking Alliance. It's a not-for-profit group that's compiled a list of 2,000 large companies it says have the most influence over our ability to move to a more sustainable future. It will now rank those firms listed on their performance on the UN's Sustainable Development Goals and make the results publicly available to all, thereby holding businesses to account by highlighting peer-to-peer performance. Here's Paulina Murphy, Engagement Director with the World Benchmarking Alliance.
Some companies will measure in energy and decarbonisation. Other companies will look at food and agriculture production and impact. Other companies will look at digital inclusion. We have a social system, a finance system, an urban system and a circular system. So it depends on the business and what it does and its core purpose. There are 15 companies that are headquartered in Ireland. We'll be looking at the Kerry Group. They'll be included in our social system, and as a food and beverage company, we're looking at them on their food and agricultural impact. And Ryanair will be looking at in the energy and decarbonisation system.
Well, when you think of big business, inevitably one of the negatives that comes to mind is corruption. Has there been any discussion around that this week?
Yes, another organisation that will be keeping tabs on businesses and governments over the next year is Transparency International. It launched its annual Corruption Perception Index here this week and warned that corruption is undermining the rule of law and weakening democracy in a number of countries. Among them is Malta, which the organisation claims is still mired in corruption 2 years after the death of reporter Daphne Caruana Galizia, who was killed in a 2017 car bomb explosion while investigating corruption. Bottom of the rankings, though, are Somalia, South Sudan and Syria. The best performers are Denmark and New Zealand, with Ireland coming in a respectable 18th out of 180 countries, up on last year. Transparency International's chairperson Delia Ferreira Rubio has been telling me about the best ways to reduce corruption.
When you have good regulation of money and politics and you enforce that, the undue influence of money in politics is controlled in a way, and you have lower levels of corruption. So we have to use this as a tool for bettering the situation, to improving what we have in terms of rules, in behavior of our public officials in several countries, to invite the business sector to participate actively in the fight against corruption.
That's Della Ferreira Rubio from Transparency International there. A lot of tech companies will seem to have been at Davos this week, and I see the issue of ethics and regulation of technology has been talked about a lot.
Yes, with the bosses of Google, Apple, Microsoft and others in town, inevitably issues like regulation of artificial intelligence, ethics in technology and privacy have been parsed and analysed. One Irish participant in Davos this week was Cillian Kieran, the founder and CEO of Ethica, a New York-based startup that builds software to automate data privacy for companies. He thinks Ireland is about to play a significant role in the evolution of privacy standards across big tech. Here's why.
I think Helen Dixon and her team at the DPC have done an incredible job, and that's easy to say, but candidly, as you say, they're effectively the front line for Europe as it relates to big tech from the US. There's several pending investigations. I think those are going to have real teeth, and the reason that they've taken so long is to ensure that they are valid investigations that really result in the right sort of impact as it relates to those businesses' changes in behaviour. So I think we're going to see a fundamental shift in how industry or business perceives data regulation and data behaviour following those regulatory findings in the next 6 months. And they will have real impact.
That's Cillian Kieran of Ethica ending that report from Davos. Brian Finn is here with the business news.
Thanks, Gavin. S&P Global Ratings has warned that the coronavirus outbreak could knock a percent off Chinese economic growth this year. The outbreak is having an impact on equities too, with European markets closing lower for a fourth straight session yesterday. Asian stocks have been particularly badly hit, but some of the markets outside of mainland China, as well as US markets, made back some losses overnight after the World Health Organization said there was no global emergency as yet. The billionaire financier and philanthropist George Soros has called US President Donald Trump a narcissist and a con man. In his by now annual speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Mr. Soros warned of a growing threat of populism in the world. He said China and the US were being run by authoritarian rulers. Competition authorities in the UK have launched a last-minute review into the £6 billion merger of Takeaway.com and Just Eat. The deal, one of the biggest in the UK tech sphere in recent years, had been scheduled to close in the coming days. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.105 and 84.2 pence sterling.
John Murray is here. The Reds go marching on.
They do indeed. They're 16 points clear at the top of the Premier League after a 2-1 win away to Wolves at Molineux last night. A late Roberto Firmino goal gave the league leaders victory after Wolves' Raul Jimenez had cancelled out Henderson's first half goal. Tranmere Rovers, meanwhile, will host Manchester United in the FA Cup fourth round on Sunday after beating Premier League side Watford in last night's third round replay at Prenton Park. Tranmere, who lie 19th in League One, won 2-1 after extra time. Rory McIlroy has made a good start to his PGA season with a 5-under par 67 in the Farmers Insurance Open at Torrey Pines. He lies in joint third position, one shot off the lead. His round contained 7 birdies and 2 bogeys. Stephanie Meadow began her 2020 LPGA Tour campaign with a 1-under par 71 to take a share of 16th place following the first round of the Gainbridge LPGA at Boca Rio. Not such a great start to her maiden season on tour for Leona Maguire. She shot a 7-over par 79. American Jessica Corda leads the event on 6-under par. To Gaelic games now, and the big news this morning, less than a week after leading Ballyhale Shamrocks to a record 8th All-Ireland Club Hurling title, manager Henry Shefflin has stepped down from his role. He took over the reins in late 2017, oversaw back-to-back All-Ireland victories as part of a run of 17 wins in Championship Hurling. The 41-year-old informed his panel last night that he would not be renewing his 2-year term, citing family and work commitments. And it's a big weekend, of course, in GAA ahead with the commencement of the Allianz Hurling and Football Leagues and the Little Ladies National Football League. We're going to talk hurling now to Anthony Daly. And Anthony, before we get to discuss the Hurling League and the new format, a word on Henry Shefflin's decision to quit. A big surprise?
Hi, John. How you doing? Morning. Huge news, really. Hard to believe, really, he's gone, but so what a job, 2 years in, to all Ireland clubs. The man doesn't do anything. You know, he's incredible.
And that he's been tipped as a successor to Brian Cody. Does this suggest that he's going to take some time out from the game and reappraise the future? I think we've... can you hear me, Anthony?
Yeah, John, I suppose we were all a bit surprised, John. Maybe the line is crossed here, John. I don't know what's happening here between Dublin and West Clare.
Can you... Hello? You can hear me, can you? I'm just saying, making the point that he has been tipped as a successor to Brian Cody. Yes, we don't seem to... Yeah, we seem to have a problem with that.
Yeah, apologies, John. Yeah, I have you clear now, I think.
Right, okay. Yes, what about that now? Does
I have you, John, yeah.
All right, Anthony. Let's move on to talk about the Allianz Hurling League, a new format, two groups of six with semi-finalists and quarter-finalists to emerge from both groups. Are you a fan of the new system?
Yeah, Don, I suppose he has, but you would look at Brian Cody's set up there. He's after bringing in.
Yes, there seems to be a long delay on the line. I think we'll have to leave it there, Anthony. For some reason, the connection not the best. In other sports news this morning, well, actually, we can go back to that earlier news about Liverpool's 16-point, the extension of the lead at the top of the Premier League to 16 points after that victory over Wolves. Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp was particularly warm in his praise of his captain Jordan Henderson afterwards.
I'm not sure since when Henderson was involved in offensive set pieces. Usually for most of the time he was protection. So now we found a way to involve him as well, and that he scores that goal is obviously incredible, and it's just another sign for his outstanding shape in the moment. Played an unbelievable game tonight again, in a difficult game where he's really shouting at everybody. It pretty much keeps everybody on their toes. It's not about shouting, it's about what you say. It's about... he asks us from him, but he only asks for things he expects from himself as well. So it's nothing, he doesn't have a run for me or do this or that. So it's just good. Yeah, we couldn't be in a situation we are without these kind of characters.
There's a long way to go in this season. It just seems like it's an inevitable cruise. Now, look, it's very enjoyable after 30 years of not winning a league, but... what's left for Liverpool fans to enjoy in this league?
Well, they
now
can still afford to lose six matches between now and the end of the season and win the league. So, sure, isn't there everything to enjoy?
Is there a danger? The latest danger fear here, and this is just sort of red paranoia, is that they'll win the league too early, they'll take the gas off, and then they'll just be dumped out of the Champions League like Pep Guardiola teams over the years.
Don't be so pessimistic, Gavin. They'll win everything. They'll win everything around them. Let's face it. Now, the big news in tennis: seven-time champion Serena Williams has been knocked out of the Australian Open, losing 6-4, 6-7, 7-5 to China's Wang Qiang in the third round. The defeat means the 38-year-old American's quest for a record-equalling 24th Grand Slam singles title goes on. In the men's singles, defending champion Novak Djokovic took only 85 minutes to defeat Yoshihito Nishioka 6-3, 6-2, 6-2 and reached the fourth round. There's racing today at Dundalk. The first is off at 5. And for sports news updates during the day, you can check out the RTE News Now app and rte.ie.
Going to turn now to one of the day's other big news stories. After a surge in drug use, antisocial behaviour and a number of murders, the people of Drogheda say they've had enough. And on Saturday, residents are going to take part in a march through the town to protest at what they say is a failure to address the growing threat to their safety. The protest is being organised by Paul Bell. He's the mayor of Drogheda, and a number of groups who are helping victims of crime and families facing drug debts and threats. And Paul Bell joins us now. I know that there has been, or there was rather, a similar march in the past. What do you hope that this can achieve?
Good morning, Rachel. Well, in the past we've had a demonstration to allow those who are involved in the drug trade, that be the residents and citizens of Drogheda, will not tolerate this ongoing feud, the misery that's bringing to communities, both by violence, intimidation, and really a situation whereby in some areas of our town people are finding it unbearable to live. The last protest did bring about some change in that the Garda resources were increased after a number of years trying to increase those Garda resources. We managed to achieve the attention of the Chief Garda Commissioner, Drew Harris, whereby also other resources needed to tackle this type of crime were deployed in Drogheda. And in fairness to An Garda Síochána, in Drogheda, there has been successes in confronting this type of crime, making arrests, and basically identifying those who are involved in this trade, which is of absolute abhorrence to the people of Drogheda and surrounding areas.
It goes without saying that, you know, the people involved in this, we're talking about a very small number of people whom the vast majority of people in the town obviously want to have nothing to do with. And I suppose the murder of Keane Mulready Woods, it really highlighted what some people, though, are prepared to do. What's it like at the moment for people who are living in those areas that have been badly affected by this feud?
Well, there's a considerable amount of anxiety. There's a considerable amount of fear. And the people of Drogheda, in some areas in particular, are suffering from terror fatigue. But having said that, people are coming together. They're beginning to understand that this issue is a community issue. It's not just a Garda issue. It's not just an issue for the legislators of our country, but it's a community issue. And if they get support, they will be able to defeat this situation. Drogheda, in its history, has had many challenges over its 900-year period. And unfortunately, this challenge will be met by the people. There's an understanding also that people of the town and surrounding areas, this is not just an issue for Drogheda, it's also an issue for other parts of our country. People know that they have to come together to confront this issue, to support the authorities in trying to address what is a very, very serious and ongoing feud, but also to protect their own communities.
Another issue has emerged in particular over the past week or so, and that's the extent to which those who use drugs in what might be termed a recreational manner, the extent to which those people are part of this problem.
Well, tomorrow's demonstration in Drogheda, and I'm sure this will be shared by many people throughout this country, this is not just an issue that's specific to Drogheda. We want to achieve a number of things. First of all, we want the legislator to address the ongoing issues and empowering the Garda Síochána to deal with those involved in this type of activity, because at the end of the day, it is threatening the democracy of our state. There's another thing that we want to achieve, and that is the term recreational drug use. We want that struck out from any kind of vocabulary, because there is no such thing as recreational drug use. There's either citizens who use drugs or citizens who do not use drugs. By using drugs, it is literally feeding this ongoing criminal activity. Some of these criminal organisations have huge assets, which has been borne out by the success of the Criminal Assets Bureau over the years. But again, if people are caught with the using small amounts of cocaine or any other type of drug, there's a strong belief in the communities that suffer from the effects of this crime that those people should be held accountable and should be convicted under the criminal justice system. The day of excusing people in certain parts of our society for drug use has to come to an end.
Paul Bell, Mayor of Drogheda, thank you so much for joining us on Morning Ireland.
Finland is the only country in the EU which has seen a reduction in homelessness in recent years. In the past 12 years, Finland has seen a 38% drop in long-term homelessness, while Ireland has seen one of the highest increases in homelessness in that time. There are now more than 10,400 people in emergency accommodation here. Juliet Gash reports.
In 2008, we had around 8,000 homeless persons in Finland. And now we have the actual figure is 5,500.
Juha Kaukinen is CEO of the Y Foundation, an NGO working with homeless people in Finland. He says the vast majority of those do have housing arrangements.
It's important to understand that 75% of them are people living temporarily with friends and relatives. So the actual number of homeless people is rather small, and we don't have street homelessness anymore in Finland. Also, what I think is significant is that we have only 150 homeless families. So there's a very small amount of families with children if you compare to the Irish situation.
The number of homeless families in Ireland is more than 10 times that. Last November, there were 1,685 homeless families living in emergency accommodation. For comparison's sake, Finland has a population of 5.5 million people. The Republic's is 4.9 million. So how has Finland reversed the trend that's been so pervasive in Ireland? The answer lies in Housing First, an approach also favoured by the Peter McVerry Trust. Its CEO is Pat Doyle.
Housing First is taking the most entrenched and most vulnerable homeless people, which are rough sleepers, and offering them a home immediately with wraparound supports. And the wraparound supports can deal with their mental health, addiction and any other issues they may have. And it's completely turning the housing model on its head. Before, we used to give people into a hostel and say, when you deal with your mental health and addiction, we'll give you a house. But this is saying, we'll give you the house and that'll aid you and we'll help you deal with all the other issues.
Juha Kaukinen also says that politicians were united in their determination to reduce homelessness once and for all.
In 2008, there was a complete change in the policy based on the Housing First policy. And there has been a political consensus. We have had several governments since 2008, and all of those have agreed to continue to work to end homelessness. And now the present government has made a decision that the rest of the homelessness should be halved by 2023 and ended completely by 2027.
While Housing First has been government policy for some time in Ireland, it's not had near the same impact as in Finland. In fact, homelessness has been steadily increasing since 2008. Pat Doyle says we need to build on the success of Housing First.
We need to be tripling the numbers. So we need to make sure that everybody that's mentioned on the Housing First plan, which is around 800 to 900 people at the moment, we need to be trebling that so that it becomes the mainstream response. It is a response from government. We're very happy with it. But still, when you ring the free phone, the majority of people offer the free phone are offered a bed in a hostel. And I suppose we need to move towards other European countries, such as Finland, where when you ring, it's Housing First as the first response.
That was Pat Doyle from the Peter McVerry Trust here, ending that report by Juliet Gash.
And you're welcome back to County Clare. This morning we've been hearing from people in the county on what matters to them as the election campaign continues. Our reporter Tommy Meskell got a snapshot of views on the main street in Ennis-Dymon.
I think the main thing is health, number one. Limerick, and that's just not Limerick, you know, and the overcrowding and the trolleys. It's just the thought of getting ill. My mother is 88 and we're caring for her at home, and we are praying that nothing happens, that she has to go to hospital.
What concerns me would be the old age pension, because I'm an old age pensioner and it's hard to live in a 250 a week. It's a state pension, it's hard to live in it. So that's one thing. I'm sure for a lot of the young people, I suppose the employment would be a big thing for them, you know.
We're here in Ennis-Dymon, a town that's seen as one that's doing quite well. Would you agree with that?
Oh, it is. It has improved a lot over the years. Yeah, it is doing pretty good. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. Yeah, but still, there is. It's remote enough. You have to travel to Innes, Limerick, or Shannon, like in or Galway, for jobs. You know.
And just finally, can I ask you about Blake's Corner?
Oh, it should have been knocked. Blake's Corner should have been, the house should have been knocked, and moved back when the recession started, and rebuilt stone by stone, and traffic would flow.
Pat Tierney, Cooley House in Stein, County Clare. Our town is thriving, all right. There's a lot of buildings were vacant, and now they've become occupied again, you know, with new businesses in the town, new restaurants and the whole lot. And
what's the reason for that?
I don't know, really. It seems the way to go now is coffee shops and eating houses, more so than my business, a public house, you know. But I get a lot of Americans in, you know. And it's great to see them coming over every year, and I do get a lot of repeat business off the Americans, which is fantastic, you know.
Those views from Ennis-Dymon, gathered by our reporter Tommy Meskell.
Let's get a weather forecast. Matthew Martin is at Met Air. Morning, Matthew.
Thanks, Gavin. Well, high pressure continues to be positioned close to Ireland, and this means the weather over the next few days will be mostly dry, but there will be a good deal of cloud across the country. However, there will be a big change in our weather from Sunday as cold and showery weather takes hold. For today, most areas will be dry apart from patches of mist and drizzle. It'll be cloudy across the bulk of the country, but there will be occasional sunny interludes, and maximum temperatures today will range from 6 or 7 degrees to 10 degrees. It will stay mostly cloudy then for tonight, but mainly dry again, with just a few patches of light rain or drizzle. And then for the weekend, there will be a good deal of dry weather across the country on Saturday, but with plenty of cloud and scattered patches of drizzle and mist. And the best of any bright or sunny spells tomorrow will be in the east and northeast of the country, with highest temperatures ranging from 6 to 9 degrees. Then on Saturday night, a band of rain will push in from the Atlantic, extending eastwards across the country. And this band of rain will herald the change to a much colder and more unsettled phase of weather. On Sunday, that rain is going to clear quickly from the east of the country during the morning, and that will leave a cold and blustery day with sunshine and scattered showers, and some of the showers will turn wintry on Sunday. Maximum afternoon temperatures then for Sunday of 4 to 7 degrees. And then there will be widespread wintry showers across the country on Sunday night, with some falls of snow possible. And then looking ahead, the early days of next week will bring further cold and showery conditions, with wintry showers expected and sharp frost at night. But to recap then for today, generally dry but rather cloudy, with patches of mist and drizzle. That's the forecast. Thanks for listening and have a good morning.
Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil manifestos will favour spending increases over tax cuts. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Times, which reports on what the manifestos, which are expected to be announced today, are likely to contain. The coronavirus generates the lead story in three of today's papers. The Irish Independent leads with the line that Dublin Airport has been advised by the HSE to take infection control precautions in the event of a passenger travelling from China showing potential symptoms of the virus. The Independent also references the case of the man who is undergoing tests at the Royal Hospital in Belfast, which provides the lead story in today's Belfast Telegraph. It's reported that the man travelled to Northern Ireland from the city of Wuhan, where the virus originated last weekend. Details from an interview carried on this programme yesterday with Irishman Ben Kavanagh, who is currently working as a teacher in Wuhan, provides the lead story in the Irish Daily Mirror. The Examiner leads today with the inquest into the death of four-year-old Killian O'Driscoll, who died in hospital after he became acutely ill at the Kindercare childcare creche in Ballincollig in December 2018. Cork Coroner's Court heard yesterday that Killian had been diagnosed with autism and had communication difficulties which the creche was aware of. For its lead story, The Echo reports on videos posted by rival gangs in Cork City on social media this week, in which the men who have their faces covered and some of whom are carrying implements issue threats of violence. A picture posted on social media by 43-year-old Linda Mulhall of herself and her daughter posing for the camera provides the lead story, meanwhile, in today's Irish Daily Star. Linda Mulhall was released from prison 2 years ago, having served 13 years for the manslaughter of Farah Noor in 2005, and her sister Charlotte is currently serving a life sentence for that murder. Under the headline, €15 million fraud gang's Irish fixer, the Herald leads with the 4.5-year jail sentence handed down to 28-year-old Radu Agapi from Romania in Dublin Circuit Criminal Court yesterday. A squabble between Fine Gael election candidates, Senator Michelle Mulhern and former Mayo footballer Alan Dillon, over the removal of posters which Senator Mulhern had put up outside what the party deemed to be her boundary, provides the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail. Craig Hughes reports that Gardaí were contacted about the removal of the posters but ceased their investigations after speaking to Fine Gael's Director of Elections for Mayo, Tom Garvey, who said that he had given permission for the posters to be removed. The Irish Sun leads today with the line that Niall Quinn is to defer his wages for his new job as interim deputy CEO of the FAI until workers at the association are assured of their future. Back in the front of the Examiner, there's a story there about a man who is disputing why he should pay for a paternity test on the basis that he already gave the expectant mother €500 to have an abortion. The man is disputing paternity in response to the mother making an application seeking maintenance payments from him. The mother has no issue with the DNA test being carried out, but insists that the man must pay for it. Judge Paul Durkin adjourned the case in Ennis Family Court until March to allow for the DNA test to be carried out. Also in the front of the Examiner, it's reported that the marquee concerts in Cork are to go ahead this summer at the Cork Showgrounds,
but that a new venue will have to be found for next year since there are plans to build 1,000 homes on the site. And finally, one of the artists who has been confirmed for this year's lineup at the Marquee also inspires an editorial in today's Examiner. In light of the election debate surrounding the pension age and how old we'll all be when we retire, the piece notes that just 5 days after his Cork gig on the 2nd of June, Tom Jones will turn 80.
With the business news next, here's Brian Finn.
Thank you, Rachel. With the election dominating the headlines here, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that Britain is scheduled to leave the EU this day next week. The Brexit bill passed all stages in the UK Parliament in recent days. Business and industry groups are continuing to prepare for the next phase in the negotiations. Faulty Ireland convened the latest meeting of its Brexit advisory group yesterday. Paul Kelly, CEO of Faulty Ireland, is here. And before we look at the strategies and the year ahead, Paul, I think it's fair to say that last year was fairly lukewarm as far as inbound tourism was concerned. Was that all down to Brexit uncertainty?
Yes, good morning, Brian. Yes, last year was a bit more of a mixed year, with overall revenue being marginally down for the industry across the year. And it was a combination of the Brexit uncertainty that was certainly a very big factor in it. But also there were other factors such as some delays in aircraft being available that limited some of our air access growth into the country, some a softening of outbound tourism from places like Germany, etc. And you know, in terms of it is important to remember that when we talk about kind of 1 or 2% growth, that this is really important from an Irish economy point of view, because it's a very labour intensive industry in tourism. So a 1% decline in tourism will lead to a drop of about 2,500 in job numbers. So it really does make small changes in tourism revenue make a big difference in absolute job numbers. And about 1,500 of those jobs would be in rural and regional areas where it would be hard to find alternative employment. So places like just your report there in Ennis Diamond is highlighting the importance of those tourism numbers to maintain those jobs in those kind of areas.
And is rural tourism being particularly badly hit? Do we see people coming to cities and town breaks?
We're certainly seeing that things are more challenging in rural and regional Ireland than in Dublin, and that's largely, I suppose, you know, Dublin has also got kind of and some of the larger cities have got kind of the corporate market that help, and they've got business travel coming in and out, which does help sustain them a little bit more. So rural areas certainly rely more on the holidaymaker and the tourism business.
What about costs? Is there a danger that we could be becoming a high price destination again?
We certainly, as we face into these choppier waters that are ahead of us, we absolutely need to kind of keep our focus on competitiveness. There are a lot of cost pressures coming into industry. The issue of insurance costs has been well publicised. There are other inflationary pressures around wages and other factors that businesses are facing. So, you know, we do need to make sure that we're absolutely not complacent with regards to tourism in the context of there is softening in demand happening, and we do have increased cost pressures coming in.
Looking to the year ahead, there's perhaps a bit of a reprieve from Brexit. Would you expect the uncertainty to ramp up again fairly quickly?
Well, certainly in our Brexit advisory group, which has kind of overseen the comprehensive programme that Faulty Ireland have had for the last number of years, where we've helped over 3,000 businesses prepare for Brexit, that group has certainly kind of flagged to us that the clarity that's now there for this year does provide some certainty, and that is certainly welcome for this year. But there are big questions as to what happens at the end of this year when the transition period ends, and there's obviously a lot of work to be done between now and then. Our sense is that it'll be kind of summer before we get some kind of sense as to how that work is going.
Paul Kelly, CEO of Faulty Ireland, thank you very much indeed for that. We'll have more business news at 8:30. Now it's back to Gavin.
The news is read by Karen Creed.
Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil will publish their general election manifestos today in Dublin. Other parties will be publishing policies on cervical check, childcare and restoring trust in politics. Our political correspondent Paul Cunningham.
At its manifesto launch at 12, RTÉ News understands that Fine Gael will propose helping owner-occupiers in towns and villages with fewer than 2,000 people. They will be able to buy a site at cost price from 1,400 serviced and publicly owned land banks across the country. On health, it's believed Fine Gael will publish a €5 billion package involving recruiting 5,000 additional nurses and 3,000 additional primary healthcare workers by 2025 and capping hospital car parking charges at €10 per day. Fianna Fáil's manifesto will be launched at 2 o'clock. On health, it will recruit 1,000 consultants, nearly 5,000 additional nurses, increase the GP allowance and abolish car parking charges at hospitals. The party plans to introduce a commission on taxation, reduce capital gains tax from 33% to 25% and to quadruple some childcare provisions. Elsewhere in the campaign, the Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald is in Kerry, both to canvass and to outline the party's proposals on cervical check. Labour's Éan Oireachtain will publish his party's proposal for a publicly funded childcare system. The Green Party leader Eamon Ryan will be canvassing in Kerry, while the Social Democrats will launch a policy document in Dublin entitled Restoring Trust in Politics and Public Life.
26 people are now known to have died in the outbreak of the respiratory virus in China, which has led to a number of cities being sealed off. There are more than 800 confirmed cases of the new strain of the coronavirus. Travel restrictions have been imposed in the city of Wuhan, where the outbreak started, and in the surrounding region. The Chinese authorities hope the measures will stop the spread of infection. The World Health Organization has said it will continue to monitor the outbreak, having decided not to declare it an international public health emergency. Test results on a man who's been treated for symptoms associated with the coronavirus at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast are expected today. It's understood the man travelled to Northern Ireland at the weekend from the Chinese city of Wuhan. It's believed he's being treated in an isolation ward as a precautionary measure. With a week to go before the UK leaves the EU, the President of the European Council, Charles Michel, and the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, have today signed the UK withdrawal agreement. The agreement, which received royal assent in Britain this week after passing through Westminster, still needs to be approved by the European Parliament, with a vote expected next Wednesday. The UK is set to enter a transition period in February, during which the relationship with Brussels will remain the same while trade talks take place, in advance of a December 31st deadline for a deal. Environmental campaigners and Democrats have criticised the Trump administration's decision to remove pollution controls in more than half of all streams and wetlands in the United States. The White House insists it's scrapping the Obama-era regulations against the advice of its own scientists in order to help American farmers. Under new regulations, landowners and businesses will be able to dump waste in areas where it was previously prohibited. Christine Whitman is a former head of the US Environment Protection Agency.
Water safety is threatened. If you don't look at what the runoff is into the various areas, it's very definitely a problem, and particularly in the Midwest and the West, where a lot of the farmers and ranchers object to some of the what they feel was overreach. You have people on wells, and it's easy to get the E. coli and chloroform into your wells.
The Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is due to chair an emergency meeting to discuss the government's response to a storm that has led to the deaths of 13 people. Four others are missing after violent winds, heavy rain, snow and flooding caused widespread problems in the east of the country. Storm Gloria swept into the Balearic Islands, which include the holiday island of Mallorca, last weekend. It then struck Catalonia, Valencia and the southern regions of Murcia and Andalusia. And now the time is 4 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Stay safe, stay clear when working near overhead electricity wires. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Most areas will be dry today, apart from a few patches of light rain or drizzle. It will be cloudy across the bulk of the country, but there will be occasional sunny intervals. Highest temperatures of 7 to 10 degrees in mostly light breezes with some mist and localised fog patches.
You're welcome back to the Old Ground Hotel here in Ennis in County Clare. Yesterday's fog has lifted and the light is now seeping into the sky outside our window here. Well, if nothing else, it would seem elections are a boost for the local newspaper business. Both this week's Clare Echo and Clare Champion are laden with colour ads for candidates. The lead story in the Champion says stage is set as 15 seek 4 seats. While The Echo's political columnist Owen Nealon says that either the Green Party's Roisin Garvey or the former Labour TD and now independent Michael McNamara could spring a surprise here. One piece of non-election news, interestingly common to the two papers, is the welcome afforded to a group of asylum seekers who recently arrived in Ennis. Indeed, one of those asylum seekers has written a piece for The Echo this week. Now, shortly, we'll be joined by a number of guests to discuss the issues and the electoral contest here in this four-seat constituency. But before we do, we can hear from some business owners in Ennis. They were gathered by our reporter, Tommy Meskell.
I want the hospital open and I want the, everything is over there for it. And I tell you, the people in Nina want their hospital open as well. And I think it would be very good for everybody.
It doesn't look like it's going to happen anyway. There's been no real movement towards that, has there?
No. It's the cost.
Two schools have closed in the last few months in West Clare. So that it would be a concern very much for people that would have, you know, there must be no jobs. And jobs are, if you don't have jobs, people can't stay in the place.
You're standing outside Tierney's. You own Tierney's?
My wife does.
Can I just ask you, the town itself, you're so familiar with this. Yeah. How has it fared over the last couple of years? Is there room for improvement?
It's dying on its feet. It's gone. The shop, the town is gone. All we say, the small businesses are all gone now. You know, and the bypass didn't help us, I reckon myself.
I have children in full-time childcare, and I'm paying the full amount, obviously, because I work full-time. I've been working since I was 16.
How expensive is childcare here in Ennis?
Well, we pay £3.20 a week for two kids in full-time childcare a week. That's more than our mortgage.
Hi, I'm John O'Connor. I own Custy's Music Shop with Francis Custy. We're here right in the heart of the beautiful town of Ennis, County Clare, renowned for music, culture and chancers.
You will be very well known around Ennis and Clare and beyond. Ahead of this election, what would a business owner like you have on their mind? What concern would you have on your mind?
It's a kind of a general concern, really, as regards business and in a town like this. I mean, every town, every small town on the Western Seaboard is in a state of desolation. There's a lot of dereliction. There's a lot of rate changes, rate increases. Nobody seems to have the common sense to realise that certain niche businesses, very family-owned businesses, have great appeal nationally and internationally, and there's very little recognition given to that.
Some views there from around the town of Ennis. Well, with us this morning here at our table in the window of the Town Hall Cafe, looking out onto O'Connell Street, are Porrick McMahon. He's the head of news and sport with the Clare Echo. Also here, Margaret O'Brien, the chief executive of Ennis Chamber of Commerce. And with us too, outgoing independent TD, Dr. Michael Hartley. Porrick, let's start with you. There are, I think it's fair to say, there are several different Clares. On the one hand, you have towns like Ennis and Shannon. On the other hand, you have a lot of quieter, more rural areas. What, in your assessment, are the big issues in this constituency?
The big issues, Rachel, I suppose, and you'd be right in saying different areas, but the big issues would be common in that health, looking at overcrowding in University Hospital Limerick, that's a big concern. Employment, looking at Moneypoint, Rosh, Avera, Molex, big closures affecting a lot of people. And then Shannon Airport, which would underpin tourism. So Shannon Airport had an 8% drop in passenger numbers last year. Tourism, Clare, needs to thrive on it. And I saw Michael McNamara commenting in the Irish Independent that Clare has become like Jurassic Park. People are coming down on buses just for a look and off again. So the candidate that can tick those boxes, and really if someone could sell that they could really promote Shannon Airport, they would have a great chance of getting into Dáil Éireann.
We'll look at some of the contenders later, but is it fair to say that this has always been a great constituency to spring a surprise? We had Michael Hartley here 4 years ago. In the past, you had James Breen, the independent. Of course, going back to the year of the spring tide, there was Dr. Musaji Bamji.
Yeah, exactly, Rachel. And I think this time round, I would say Clare is going to indicate what the national picture is in. So if Clare can elect two Fianna Fáil TDs, it will probably be Fianna Fáil in government. And if Clare can retain their two Fine Gael TDs, we would probably have a Fine Gael-led government.
Michael Hartley, you were elected 4 years ago as a campaigner, in particular on the lack of GPs in rural areas. You're not running again. Would it be fair to say that you found the last 4 years frustrating?
That would be the word I would use, Rachel, yes. And I did run on relation to rural medical services, but it expanded out into rural sustainability, really. The lack of services within rural Ireland, the depopulation of rural Ireland, the schools, as we mentioned, closing in rural Ireland, lack of services, post offices closing around the country, 159 post offices closed during my term in office, which was extremely disappointing. So it was about rural sustainability. Yes, medical services were important and they still are important. The issue of retaining rural GPs is still very much to the fore. We have an issue in Newmarket and Fergus where a list hasn't been filled now for over 9 months. And
Newmarket and Fergus is not a tiny place. I mean, it's a substantial village.
No, Newmarket and Fergus is within a commuting distance of Ennis, Limerick. It's quite a central village. And the issue really is around the contracts that underpin rural general practice in general. So the issue has extended now from rural areas into our county towns and our villages. And that is an issue which hasn't been addressed by government. And I did try to address it in my time there, but unfortunately I didn't get a listening ear.
Taking all of this into account, and you know, we're looking at a situation where we have 15 people, as we were saying, contending for these seats, wanting to represent the county. But you know, what can one TD do?
Well, I think independent TDs have an important role to play in government because they give an alternative point of view. They give a different view to the traditional parties. And I think many of the independent TDs in the Dáil, in the 32nd Dáil, did give those alternative views. You do have to have a receptive ear, and some people just are not willing to listen. I found that difficult when I was there, that from a medical point of view, as a GP, I had a unique view on how general practice worked, how public health nursing worked, community intervention teams, community psychiatric teams, and how primary care and secondary care interact. The Sláinte Care Reform Programme, I think, was one of the unique things that developed out of this Dáil.
And that's something that has cross-party support.
That has cross-party support. The issue really is we are wonderful at producing reports. We're very poor at implementing them. And that's the issue with Sláinte Care. It is very slow to get off the ground. And you cannot reform a health service from current spending. You have to have ring-fenced, unique spending to reform the service. And that hasn't been forthcoming so far.
We can come back to some of what it's possible to achieve and maybe what it's not possible to achieve as far as the health service is concerned. But I want to bring in Margaret O'Brien, Chief Executive of Ennis Chamber of Commerce. I think if you asked people in other parts of the country or even other parts of the county, there may be a sense that Ennis recovered more quickly from the recession than some other places. Is that a fair assessment?
I think, to be honest, it took a while for Ennis to recover. And I think we've a new sort of Ennis now, Rachel. I think that we're very fortunate in Ennis because, during the boom, people thought we were unlucky because we didn't have the typical anchor high street stores in Ennis. And that was an issue around our medieval town centre and conservation and all of those issues and the kind of footprint they needed. I think it's now to our advantage because the independent spirit that has existed down through the years is actually what's carrying the town now. We're really fortunate because there's a cohort of retailers in this town who literally lift their heads every morning and they come in, and I see it when I'm working late at night. The shops that are doing well in this town, the people who are positive, the lights are on in the evening, they're doing their Facebook, they're updating their website. It's a long, long day for the retailers who are really in business for business at the moment. So it's a new paradigm for them, really.
Jobs in the Midwest, something mentioned by Porrick there. I mean, looking at the official figures, the Midwest grew last year. Its growth may be on a par with the national average. But towards the end of the year, there was that big shock announcement from Shannon with the announcement that Molex was to close. What's your assessment of the situation
there? I think what's of concern, and it sometimes doesn't get mentioned, is we're losing quality jobs. So while the figures are still good in Clare, the figures are good because we have a huge cohort of people working in tourism, which is not a well-paid sector. We still have people in farming. We have people in lesser paid jobs. And I think that's borne out by the statistics when you look at the disposable income of Clare. Like our neighbours in Limerick are second from top in Ireland now, and we're languishing down around the bottom. And similarly, even with tourism, it's about the conversion of the people. It's been mentioned this morning, the conversion of the people coming into the county. They trundle down from Dublin every morning by the busload, 1.6 million visitors to the cliffs. And yet, we're we're the fifth most visited county in Ireland and have the second worst spend per tourist visitor. That's shocking.
Michael Harty, just back briefly to you on the health question, because it has been a perennial issue here. I mean, if you go back 30 years even, I remember there was a big furore about the future of the General Hospital then. We know that a lot has changed and a lot of promises are going to be made over the next couple of weeks. Should people be wary of promises?
I think so, and I think we've seen auction politics take centre stage now with the debates over the past number of days. The issue in relation to the health service in the Midwest is extremely important to people because of the overcrowding in the regional hospital in Limerick, and that goes back to the reconfiguration of our services 10 or 12 years ago, where beds were closed in Ennis, Nida and St John's, but they were not put into the regional hospital. So bed capacity is a huge issue, and there are solutions in plain sight, but they're just not being implemented because they're difficult and they will cost money.
Pádraic McMahon, back to you finally. As we've heard, in 2016, this constituency returned two Fine Gael TDs, plus Timmy Dooley of Fianna Fáil, Michael Harty here. We have, as I said, Pat Breen and Joe Carey of Fine Gael. How do you see the contest shaping up this time?
Well, I'll make a bold prediction, Rachel, that no one else has said, and I'll say first-time Dáil candidate and Mayor of Clare, Councillor Cathal Crowe, is going to top the poll.
He's the man who gathered national headlines over the past few weeks because he was the first to say that he didn't want to commemorate the RIC.
That's him, and he's been campaigning for this day since he entered politics in 2004. He became the youngest councillor at the age of 21, and only last year he wasn't the youngest councillor. I think Cathal will top the poll. I think Pat Breen, junior minister, he'll get in. Timmy Dooley should also get in safely. And then the last seat is going to be the bloodbath. So there'll be loads in contention. You're talking sitting TD Joe Carey, Senator Martin Conway, Michael McNamara, who's getting a huge groundswell of support on the ground. And if Roisin Garvey can get the green wave, she'll be in the mix.
Would you call that last seat?
I couldn't call it yet.
Okay, listen, you were brave enough to name a poll topper or a potential poll topper, so we'll let you away with it. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. The full list of candidates here in the four-seat Clare constituency is as follows in alphabetical order: David Barrett, Independent; Pat Breen of Fine Gael; Joe Carey of Fine Gael; Martin Conway of Fine Gael; Cathal Crowe, Fianna Fáil; Timmy Dooley, Fianna Fáil; Roisin Garvey of the Green Party; Michael Leahy of the Irish Freedom Party; Independent Trudy Layden; Independent Michael McNamara; Conor O'Brien of Renewa; Teresa O'Donoghue of Solidarity People Before Profit; Rita McInerney, Fianna Fáil; Joseph Wolfe, Independent; and Violet Ann Wynn, Sinn Féin.
26 people are now known to have died in the outbreak of the respiratory virus in China, which has led to a number of huge cities there being sealed off. There are more than 800 confirmed cases of the new strain of the coronavirus. While cases have been confirmed as far away as Japan and the United States, the Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom, says it's a bit too early to declare a global emergency.
Make no mistake, this is, though, an emergency in China. But it has not yet become a global health emergency. It may yet become one. WHO's risk assessment is that the outbreak is very high risk in China and a high risk regionally and globally. We're aware of the media reports of suspected cases in other countries, but those cases are still being investigated.
Here, one man has been treated in isolation in Belfast's Royal Victoria Hospital for symptoms associated with coronavirus. He had travelled from the city of Wuhan. Results of tests for the virus are due back today. 14 people in Britain are also being tested. The HSE say they're ready to deal with the threat posed by the virus. Dr. John Cudahy is director of the HSE's Health Protection Surveillance Centre. Dr. Cudahy, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
Good morning.
What preparations are being made here?
I suppose, first of all, just to put this in context, as you mentioned, there have been 830 cases and 25 deaths, and almost all of those cases have been associated with being in Wuhan in China recently, and particularly attending markets there. And then there have been imported cases in other countries, including Thailand, Japan, South Korea, the US, and so on. And again, those cases have been in Wuhan in China recently. And The transmissibility of the infection or the spread is said to be limited at the moment to close family members and healthcare workers in China providing direct care. So in the HSE, we have a healthcare high consequence infectious disease committee that has been established for some years but has been meeting daily in recent times to optimize the preparedness and response measures. We have issued guidelines and algorithms to the GPs, hospital doctors, ambulance and public health. These are really step-by-step risk assessments, and we've also been in contact regularly with the Office of the Chief Medical Officer, and the situation is being risk assessed on a daily basis as the global situation evolves.
What have you asked Dublin Airport to do?
We have written to the Irish airports and been in contact in person and in relation to raising awareness of this particular illness. And there are established procedures in the airports where anyone with an infectious disease is reported by the captain to the point of entry. And then, there are established procedures for notifying the National Ambulance Service and public health.
Okay.
And the cabin crew on flights follow operational procedures by the International Air Transport Association in relation to managing suspected communicable disease on board an aircraft.
So what would happen if there's a person with symptoms on their way here, and who'll pick that up?
The cabin crew, well, first of all, we don't have any direct flights from Wuhan province, the affected area at the moment, to Ireland. There are direct flights to London, Paris and Rome. But when somebody displays symptoms on an aircraft, the cabin crew, as I said, use those operational procedures of the IATA. The captain is authorised to warn airports of any ill passengers on board flights, and the procedures then at the port are well established in relation to making contact with the National Ambulance Service and Public Health, who risk assess that patient. And the algorithms that we have distributed describe travel and clinical criteria. The travel criteria is that if someone has been in Wuhan province in China in the 14 days before the onset of illness, and the clinical ones are fever and respiratory symptoms, the assessment or the case definition is that the patient satisfies both the travel and clinical criteria.
Dr. Cuddy, there's no direct flights between Belfast and Wuhan province, but there's a man being in isolation, being treated for symptoms and being tested. What happens if that case turns out to be positive?
The European Communicable Disease Control Centre, as I mentioned, has done a risk assessment and considered that the likelihood of cases in European countries is moderate. Where there are no direct flights is obviously less than where there are. But it's likely that patients will present who are concerned and who have some respiratory symptoms. We're still in flu season, and they will be assessed, as we've seen in various countries, including here in Ireland. But using those algorithms and the case definition and the guidelines that we have available across the health system, these situations can be de-escalated quite quickly, as we've seen.
Okay, Dr. John Cuddy, thank you very much for taking our call. Dr. Cuddy is Director of the HSE's Health Protection Surveillance Centre.
Takeaway.com said the expected timetable for its takeover of British rival Just Eat would be delayed by a week after the UK Competition Authority said it would examine the deal. Earlier this month, Just Eat's shareholders agreed to the all-stock deal, valued at £6.2 billion. The deal, one of the biggest in the UK tech sphere in recent years, had been scheduled to close in the coming days. A debate on interest rates will take centre stage at the final day of the World Economic Forum in Davos. Ultra-low rates and in some cases negative rates worldwide have divided opinion, with the banking industry being particularly badly hit by negative borrowing costs. Some investors have warned of looming asset bubbles. And Indonesia's Lion Air is launching a pre-marketing drive for a potential public offering of shares in the airline. It's seeking to float just over a year after a fatal crash of one of its Boeing 737 MAX jets. Currencies, the euro is trading at $1.105 and 84.2 pence sterling.
After over 10 years of fundraising, the new Wicklow Hospice building is now complete. The team expects to welcome its first patients in April, but over the next few days it will open its doors to members of the public for the official opening. Located in Mahramore, overlooking the sea near British Bay, it will be the first specialist palliative care facility in County Wicklow with 15 inpatient public beds. The operational costs will be covered by the HSE, while fundraising will continue for capital costs and enhancements for patients and families. The 3.5-acre site was donated by the Columban Sisters. Let's speak to Yvan Cahill, chairperson of fundraising with Wicklow Hospice. Yvan, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
The end of a very long journey.
The end of a long journey, but what an end. We have a magnificent facility now, thanks to the people of County Wicklow, who raised this money and supported us relentlessly over the last, actually, nearly 11 years now. I'm here today to thank them particularly, and to thank all the volunteers who work and continue to work so hard on behalf of the Wicklow Hospice, and to the Columban Sisters for the magnificent site.
It's a beautiful site.
It's absolutely beautiful. Looking out to sea, it's very peaceful, beautiful site. And we are so grateful to the Columban Sisters for giving this site to the community for this wonderful facility.
Facility for 15 people and their families.
15 beds. And the statistic, it mightn't sound a lot, but the statistic is one bed per 10,000 of population, because people will come in, they'll get their needs looked after, their pain relief, whatever they need, and then they'll go home and come back in again when they need care again. And should they choose, then we have a home care team who will go out to the homes and look after people at their end of life, or else they can choose to come to the hospice. So there will be a facility there for anybody in County Wicklow who needs that service.
Sadly, Yvan, most people who end their lives, it's ended in hospital. Tell us about why hospice provides a different way of reaching the end of life.
Yeah, hospice is a completely different experience. It's the nurses are there on a one-to-one basis with the people. It's calm, it's tranquil. It's a specialist care that hospitals can't give, because people need to have a one-to-one, that special loving care that they don't have time for in general hospitals. It's too busy. There's a calmness in a hospice that you just can't get in a public hospital. It's just incomparable, and it's no reflection on public hospitals. They have a different job to do. A person at their end of life needs specialist care, and this is what's given in a hospice.
You're chairperson of fundraising with the hospice, and it's been some effort over the last 10 years, a lot of very novel ways of raising money too.
We have done everything. We have done head shaves, leg shaves, we have done dip in the nip, golfing, running, you name it. But that's all down to the people of the county, you know, who came behind this. Everybody in the... There isn't a person in County Wicklow who hasn't contributed to this. You know, we have our politicians, our TDs, our councillors, the people, the volunteers. Everybody came behind this because it was such a badly needed facility. As you said there earlier, it is the first palliative care facility in County Wicklow. So people realise that and realise the need for it. So where it was a long journey, I think it brought the people of County Wicklow together, and we will be ever so grateful to them. And I think they will realise what they have achieved as soon as this hospice starts taking people in and giving them that special end-of-life care.
Yvan, thanks for speaking to us. That's Yvan Cahill, chairperson of fundraising with Wicklow Hospice. Information released to RT Investigates under Freedom of Information indicates that development land with the potential to provide an estimated 18,500 to 20,700 homes on nearly 400 vacant sites across the country is lying idle. In the Dublin City Council area, there's an estimated 4,710 housing units that remain unbuilt on sites with development potential. Progress reports on the vacant site levy sent to the Department of Housing by local authorities last month show that 359 sites were identified, which were subject to an anti-land hoarding levy, with their housing potential calculated at between 30 to 50 homes per hectare. In stark contrast, almost one-third of local authorities, 9 out of 31, didn't list any sites for the levy, mainly because they couldn't show a viable construction sector or housing need in their areas, the latter being required to apply the levy. Una Smith from RTE Investigates is here. Una, the vacant site levy was supposed to be the government's big stick to get developers building homes on their land and to penalise them for land hoarding. How's it working?
Well, Gavin, as you just in the introduction there, you say it's a very mixed picture. About two-thirds of local authorities are attempting to actually enforce the levy, but there are huge administrative difficulties. This is highlighted last year in their first progress reports, and I suppose the second progress reports underline it again. However, having said that, they've identified about 359 sites, as you say, across the country, and they've been able to estimate the number of houses that would potentially be built on those sites. And so it gives focus for local authorities and brings pressure to bear to I suppose, apply those levies and get development moving. But in the main, two-thirds of the sites, as I say, are have been identified. But they across the country, local authorities are expressing deep concern and dissatisfaction in relation to the administrative difficulties. And a highlighting issue here is that about over 200 sites had to be removed from the register. So about 60% of all sites that were actually on the registers had to be removed again. So that's a fairly substantial figure, and it underlines the fact that there are huge administrative difficulties. There are various reasons for this. Simple things just to, you know, to highlight. One example is that the idea of a vacant site for 12 months, how do you prove that? Some local authorities say that it's taken four site inspections. This was highlighted by Kilkenny County Council, and they're saying that An Bord Pleanála is taking decisions that makes it very onerous for local authorities to actually prove this and to actually levy the fines. And more proof that the administration is difficult is in the fines themselves. Roughly €880,000 of fines were levied in last year, which relates to the 3% of the site of 2018. But the original amount that was predicted by government was about €7.5 million. But in effect, the actual levying of fines has proved very difficult in itself also.
So could it be argued that the vacant site levy is a measure that's not possible or appropriate to implement in certain counties?
Well, this seems to be the picture emerging certainly in about a third of the sites. So like, as you highlighted, about 9 out of 31 local authorities are saying, well, really, in our counties, we don't have a viable construction sector. Limerick said we haven't had an application for a multiple housing development in about 15 years. Other places like Mayo had sites on their register, but the An Bord Pleanála said, well, you don't actually have a housing need in your county, so therefore they had to remove all the sites. Same with Donegal, they said basically they didn't think, even though they have sites on their register, they didn't think that this was a policy tool that would be effective in terms of inspiring development. So it is fair to say that many local authorities are saying, really, in terms of the time, money and resources that are going into this, effectively, it's not something that they feel is viable because they don't have the strength of the construction centre or sector or the housing need.
So what evidence is there that the site levy is working?
Well, this is shown in the fact that, and government would point to this, is that there are about 61 sites were removed due to commencement on those sites from the registers. A further about 53 got pre-planning, and another 41 were given grants of planning permission after being put on the register. So it could be argued that this stick that's been waved in some parts, these are mainly in the urban centres, is actually working and promoting development. Others have argued, and Leary Ratdown said, well, this is much more to do with the upswing in the macroeconomy and the construction sector in those areas. But there are other cities like Limerick and Galway that have rent suppression zones, so you would expect that they would have a real housing need, but they have not zero. They have not levied any fines, zero fines. So big questions about the administration, even in places where there's a very clear housing need.
Una, thank you. That's Una Smith of RTE Investigate.
And you're welcome back here to Ennis in County Clare on a cloudy morning. I can't see any posters from our window seat here on O'Connell Street. O'Connell Street, by the way, one of those narrow streets that runs through the centre of the town. Apparently, the Tidy Towns Committee did
did ask candidates not to put up posters in the centre of the town. But that, of course, doesn't mean people aren't talking about this election. Tommy Meskell visited Clare Marts in Ennis to hear what's exercising people there.
They closed the hospital, yeah. And instead of opening it.
That's obviously a concern for people in Clare.
Oh, cheers, yeah.
Why?
Because they go down to Limerick and you can't get inside the door. And there's an hospital there beyond, and they closed it, and they closed Nina and St. John's in Limerick. And why didn't they leave them open? And they're all to blame.
Would you say people are fearful of the fact that there's no 24-hour ED?
They're of course.
They all got unwell before they started closing them, sure. That is. The people they thought up, that should be sacked.
They should be sacked,
that's
true.
That's a fact.
Because it was working well before.
It was working well. I mean, there were no trolleys or anything around the place.
No.
Sure, I mean, how can you take three places and put them into one, and the one that they're putting it into, the one they're putting them into, is busier than the other three were.
Are you serious now?
You say jobs. Why jobs in Northern Ireland?
Well, jobs, you know, one reason, like, travel, like, you know, my own son now, he travels in Westlair, like, he might be in Dublin tomorrow and whatever the next day, and, you know, it's expensive business.
Basically, people, young people in Clare feel that they need to go outside of Clare for work, solid work at least.
Oh, they do, well, a lot of them, yeah, especially from West Clare. Like.
Rural isolation, I'd say, anyway, is the biggest problem here. Where I live, anyway, is getting very scarce, and a lot of old people living, like, kind of, and no young people coming up in the land or anything like that. One of my biggest points, anyway, like, kind of.
What part of Clare is that?
Milton Melbourne area. Total isolation nearly there as it is, like, in the farming community is gone, like, in it. It's gone. A lot of single farmers, like, kind of, they hadn't married, and no one take over their land, like, in that. And isolation, then, like, and you just can't drive into Milton Melbourne, like, and you could drive 3 miles from here. One time you could go drive in and have a couple of pints, no, you can't. It costs money with a taxi to go in and out, like, in. So,
what's your own situation?
I'm not married either, like, and no one hardly to take over the farm land either, like, and there's plenty, a lot around me the same way, like, and the same thing, like, and but I know it is, Rhode Island is changing.
Well, it's cattle prices, it'd be number one. I mean, I'd say factories fleecing the farmers would be number two, and there's no one looking out for Rhode Island.
The view from Ennis Mart, and our thanks to everybody who spoke to us here in Clare over the past couple of days. A reminder that in the first of a series of leaders' interviews, the Fine Gael leader, Leo Varadkar, will be speaking to our colleague Brian Dobson tonight at 7 on RTE One television. That, as I said, the first in a series of leaders' interviews. It's 2 minutes to 9.